ecoturism.org.
This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, Phil Gregory of the Children's Trust Fund will join host Craig Lubow to talk about environmental legal actions on behalf of children around the nation. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. DemocracyNow.org reports a new report accuses the meat industry of polluting the waters of the Gulf of Mexico, Chesapeake Bay, and the Great Lakes with toxic chemicals from manure and fertilizer, causing massive dead zones. The report from the environmental group Mighty says the toxins cause algal blooms, which then decompose and deprive the water of oxygen, causing fish and other wildlife to die off. The report says the meat giant Tyson Foods is the dominant influence in the pollution. NOAA.gov reports scientists have determined this year's Gulf of Mexico dead zone, an area of low oxygen that kills fish and marine life, is 8,776 square miles, an area about the size of New Jersey. It is the largest measured dead zone since dead zone mapping began there in 1985. Grist.org reports, as Keystone XL's fate is decided, activists descend on Nebraska. The Nebraska Public Service Commission is holding hearings this week to review the proposed pipeline route through the state and to determine if it will serve the public interest. As the hearings proceed, Native Americans, ranchers, and environmentalists who oppose the pipeline are making their voices heard. On Sunday, pipeline fighters marched through the streets of Lincoln, Nebraska, shutting down traffic on a dozen blocks. In late July, activists began installing solar panels along the proposed route in protest. Nebraska approved the same route for Keystone XL in 2013, before the pipeline died under President Obama. The state's approval process began anew after Trump revised Keystone XL earlier this year. If the route gets the okay, it will likely be challenged in court. And e360.yale.edu reports a new study in Science projects that climate change will increase the amount of nitrogen from fertilizers ending up in U.S. rivers and other waterways by 19% on average over the remainder of the century, and much more in hard-hit areas, most notably the Mississippi Atchafalaya River Basin, up to 24%, and the Northeast, up to 28%. That's not counting likely increases in nitrogen inputs from more intensive agriculture or other increased human population. Headlines have tended to fixate on the Gulf of Mexico dead zone, produced by nitrogen flushed down the Mississippi River from the cornfields of the upper Midwest. But the problem is already much broader than that. Last summer, for example, a 33-square-mile algae bloom caused Florida to declare a 4-county state of emergency. The problem with nitrogen is also evident on land. Atmospheric nitrogen from intensive farming and livestock operations, power plants, road traffic, and other sources now gets deposited everywhere, making soils more fertile. That has the paradoxical effect of reducing plant diversity by displacing native species adapted to nutrient-poor soils. That's all I have for the news for this evening. At this time, I'd like to turn the mic over to our host, Craig Lubow.
Okay, thank you, Naturally. Our guest today is Phil Gregory. He is an attorney with the firm in California, and he is also working as co-counsel with Children's Trust Fund for some environmental legislation on behalf of children. Welcome, Phil.
Hi, Craig.
Let's start, before we get into the specific legal cases that you're working on, if you can tell us a little bit about the trust fund.
Well, first off, Craig, it's not a trust fund. What it is it's an organization, Our Children's Trust, that is pursuing claims that our government, whether state, federal, or governments in various other nations, are essentially not serving as proper stewards for essential natural resources under the public trust doctrine, which goes back to Justinian's time. The sovereign or a state or a national government is the trustee or the steward for essential natural resources for the benefit of the youngest and future generations. And the organization, Our Children's Trust, is focused on bringing claims that primarily include claims under the public trust doctrine.
Okay. And the main case right now that you have is Juliana versus United States?
Yes, that's the case I'm working on, Craig, up in Eugene, Oregon. A great case.
All right. And was that the case? I remember there was a court opinion back, I think, in October or November by either district judge or appeals court judge that went in your favor in terms of standing, I guess it was.
Exactly. So that was a decision by Federal District Judge Ann Aiken up in Eugene, Oregon, on November 10, last year, 2016, 2 days after the election. And Judge Aiken's opinion essentially allowed our case to move forward towards trial by agreeing with us that the 21 kids on whose behalf we filed this case have claims both under the United States Constitution and under the public trust doctrine.
Okay. And so the you brought this on behalf of the 21 kids. Let me ask you, what is the tactical advantage of using children in these lawsuits as opposed to making the same claims on behalf of adults?
Well, certainly, Craig. First off, we're not using children. The plaintiffs in this case came to us and wanted to bring these claims against the federal government. And as you know, Craig, the science is not just that the emissions are the problem, but the carbon sinks are the better, are the bigger problem, and that it's going to get worse even if we flatline or start reducing fossil fuel emissions right now. So the generations that are being primarily saddled with this problem are the youngest generation and future generations. And so this, and the science on this is pretty much incontestable in terms of the problem is getting bigger, and so our kids, our grandkids, and those yet to be born are going to be faced with a country that has a climate that could become almost uninhabitable by the next century. And what these kids are saying is, why is our federal government continuing to damage us? Why is it making a conscious decision to discount our future in favor of the fossil fuel system? It's economics, or it's pollution over future generations. And we believe that this federal government has a responsibility to these kids and future generations not to saddle them with a substantial environmental problem concerning our climate.
Okay. You mentioned the term carbon sinks before. For people who are not familiar with that term, can you explain that to us?
Sure. Well, in essence, when carbon goes into the system, as scientists such as Dr. Jim Hansen have pointed out, the carbon stays there through its half-life, and as a result, the carbon problem is only going to get worse. The warming situation is only going to get worse through the global atmospheric concentrations of CO2 along with methane and nitrous oxide that are at unprecedentedly high levels compared to the past 800,000 years.
Okay. Does the suit seek to, is it against the EPA?
Yes, among others. It's against, essentially, it's essentially against the Trump administration. It focuses on specific agencies and departments, but it's we've sued the United States of America and President Trump.
Now, the original suit was started before Trump was president. Is that correct?
Exactly, because we all know that President Obama was not doing enough to address the climate situation, and as a result, the emissions were only starting to flatline at best, and so we believe that President Obama was also deliberately indifferent to the future of these kids and future generations, and so we began our suit with President Obama, and thank God we did, because the Trump administration has been much worse for the youngest generation of Americans.
All right. And part of the, back when we have those issues with Obama, you're saying he was indifferent. Was it the case that he was really indifferent, or that as a political reality, the opposition party in Congress was essentially blocking him from doing anything?
Well, let's be absolutely clear. What Obama did in the last year or two of his administration, he could have done in the first year or two of his administration. The Clean Power Plan, he did that under federal regulations and authorizing statutes. Congress didn't pass any legislation either when the Democrats were in control of Congress or when the Republicans were in control of Congress during his administration that gave him the basis for the Clean Power Plan. That went back decades. So he had that authority. Clinton had that authority. Clinton Gore had that authority. And find out from Al Gore what they actually did other than write reports and hold meetings. Both of those administrations, no matter what they say to you, they did nothing substantively that's going to have a long-term effect to help these kids and future generations.
All right. And so in terms of the goal of the lawsuit, what specific actions are they seeking to compel the EPA to do?
You know, Craig, that's a very important question. So like the civil rights cases, such as Brown versus Board of Education, and the California prison cases, that all of them went up to the United States Supreme Court, when you find that there's been a constitutional violation resulting in our government causing harm to citizens, again, like the civil rights cases with segregation or the overcrowding in the California prison system, the court can find that there's been harm, and the court can determine what is the appropriate target or goal that needs to be reached. The schools must be integrated by a certain date. Prison overcrowding must be reduced to a certain level by a specific date. And then the courts require the government involved, for example, the California prison system, the school districts in the civil rights cases, to come up with a plan to meet that court-ordered target or goal. Here, what we're saying is the science will be before the court. The science will say that the court has to set out essentially a process by which the federal carbon footprint is brought to zero, and the federal government's ability to enable the footprint of others is brought to zero, and then order the federal government to come up with a plan to achieve that goal. So the plan will be a government-developed plan which the government will then be responsible for to implement. But the targets or the goals will be based on the science that is introduced as evidence in the courtroom.
All right. Now, you mentioned the Clean Power Plan. If you'll tell us a little bit about what that does or what the goal of it was.
The Clean Power Plan is directed to the states. It's not a, it's nothing where the federal agencies themselves are going to be responsible for reducing the federal footprint. So, the Clean Power Plan was an element of President Obama's attempt to reduce carbon pollution, but the Clean Power Plan was not designed to provide a complete or thorough response to federal climate change issues.
Okay, so would you be looking for the court to order the EPA to come up with a plan that would be similar then to that, to the Clean Power Plan that they adopted for the states?
Well, Craig, the concept is, it's not similar to the Clean Power Plan. It's a plan, excuse me, for the federal government to, I'm going to call it, change its ways. No longer as business as usual, but to change its ways based on the various policy options. So, for example, using renewables rather than relying on systemic fossil fuels. And make sure you understand, Craig, the federal government has had these plans available to be put in place since the late 80s, early 1990s. These plans have been updated. They exist. They just, no one has had the willingness, the guts, the leadership to put these plans in place, both for the federal government and to impose them on the systemic fossil fuel industry that's really causing the problem here.
Okay. We are ready to take our first break. We'll be back in a couple minutes with Phil Gregory from the Children's Trust Fund. We are talking about legal actions in the courts related to help children relating to pollution and environment.
Managing water levels in the St. Lawrence on this current cast. The water levels in Lake Ontario and the St. Lawrence River have been tightly constrained since the 50s. Lee Wilbanks of the nonprofit Save the River says the lack of occasional highs and lows is one reason invasive species have proliferated.
And so you didn't have the occasional highs that would go in and allow muskrat and other species to sort of clear out the wetlands.
Now, many St. Lawrence wetlands are clogged with cattails, and species like the black tern and northern pike have declined. A new plan for managing water levels was recently put in place. Plan 2014 is an attempt to balance the needs of property owners and the environment. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more at currentcast.org.
For 30 years, KKFI has been supported by listeners just like you. Thank you for being there for us so we can be there for you. To help sustain independent community radio, go to kkfi.org and click donate.
Okay, thank you. We are back with Phil Gregory. He's an attorney working on some legal actions with our Children's Trust. And we are going to open up the other line as well for phone calls. If you have any questions or comments, you can call us at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. Okay. Phil, we talked about what happened back in the fall with this case, but I understand that it was some more recent action by the Ninth Circuit in, it looks like, in July of this year?
Yes, Craig. So the federal government has filed what's called an extraordinary writ of mandamus, and it's asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to review Judge Aiken's order from November 10, 2016. And the federal government used as a basis for asking Judge Aiken to review this order that it has been, according to federal government, overburdened with having to produce documents in our case. And we are we're amazed, to put it politely, that they've taken this view, because the federal government has not produced but I'm going to call it 20 pieces of paper in this case. And we both know that that's nothing for this federal government. So we're amazed that the federal government has taken this position, but we're going to be addressing this with the Ninth Circuit at the end of this month, and we believe the Ninth Circuit will see that, like Chicken Little, the federal government was out screaming that the sky was falling, when that simply wasn't the case at all.
And you mentioned Judge Aikens in the November decision, but I see there's also Magistrate Judge Thomas Coffin. What is his involvement on the case?
Sure. In a federal case, the there's both what's called a judge appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate under Article 3 of the Constitution, and then there are judges who serve as magistrates who are not appointed by the president or confirmed by the Senate. And so a magistrate judge, he or she issues what are called findings and recommendations on a matter, and then those findings and recommendations are reviewed by the what we'll call the district court judge, or the judge appointed under Article 3 of the Constitution. And both Judge Thomas Coffin and Magistrate Judge Thomas Coffin and Judge Ann Aiken agreed with us in terms of that our complaint should move forward to a trial, and that trial date is set for February 5, 2018 in Eugene, Oregon.
Can you tell us a little bit, this is a federal case, but I believe there's also some state cases pending. I think on the website it said there was six cases still pending in six different states. And I know initially back two or three years ago we had a case in Kansas in which the attorney Bob Bye was representing the plaintiff. And that case went away because they said that the plaintiff did not exhaust remedies. And my understanding from Bob is that the plaintiff, I guess, decided not to pursue that. So can you update us on what you know about that, as well as the six states where they are?
Yeah, you know, Craig, I'm not at all familiar with the Kansas State case. My sole involvement has been with the federal case, but I do understand that cases are moving forward in the state of Washington, in the state of Colorado. Cases are moving forward around the nation under the public trust doctrine concerning various state constitutional provisions regarding either a healthy environment or making sure that the state appropriately stewards essential natural resources.
All right. We do have a caller on the line with the question. Caller, if you'd state your first name and where you're calling from.
And you are on the air.
Yeah, thank you. This is Jack in Shawnee.
Okay. What's your question or your comment?
Thank you. Yeah, this is great news. I appreciate the show. Couple of questions. How long will it take to litigate this, to bring the litigation to conclusion, since time is of the essence? And also, what do you think is your chance to win? I'll take my answer off here. Thanks.
Sure, Jack, those are two excellent points. First off, we're going to have the trial on February 5, 2018 in Eugene, Oregon. And there, we're going to put the science up, and science equals truth. And in a courtroom, alternative facts, that equals perjury. So we believe that based on the science, we're going to get a prompt order from Judge Aiken. That will then work its way up in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But we believe Judge Aiken will continue to hold on to the case and move forward, if she rules in our favor, with requiring the federal government to develop and implement its plan. And as to your urgency point, I can't agree with you more. We're submitting expert reports right now, and one of our experts is Dr. James Hansen. And Dr. Hansen's report will underline or emphasize the urgency for the court acting now, that we have a limited window, if any window, to get something in place, and we have to move forward as quickly as possible. We believe both Judge Aiken and Magistrate Judge Coffin are very aware of that problem, and that's why they're moving us to trial in February.
All right. If anyone else wants to call, the number is 816-931-5534. Mr. Gregory, one question I had is, is there anything the public can do to support, or do you have any requests of the public to help this along, or what can people do?
Sure, that's an excellent point. And let's start with, first off, it's important to explain what's going on to your kids and your grandkids. This is a significant problem, and we believe that the youth of America should be told what's going on, both explain how the Constitution works and how the Constitution can protect them, but also explain what's going on with the climate and why there's a severe climate problem out there. Then in terms of our trial, if anybody knows of witnesses, people who've worked in the federal government, who are prepared to talk about how the federal government refused to take steps to prevent climate change, or once the problem was brought to the attention of high-level federal employees in the mid to late 80s, they know of situations where the federal government refused to take actions, then we're more than happy to speak with those people, because those witnesses, that testimony, any documents regarding that would be significant. And finally, we've got our trial on February 5, 2018, and our plaintiffs need support. It's tough being a young kid going to trial against the federal government. You talk about a classic David and Goliath situation. That's what our kids are facing, and so they need support, whether it's on Facebook and the like. So you can go to the website of Our Children's Trust, ourchildrenstrust.org, and there's various ways, specific ways for support set forth at that website.
And I noticed, again, this is Mike Murphy, you mentioned that Jim Hansen is one of your experts involved in the case. I thought I just saw on, I think it was your website, that he's also a co-plaintiff. Is that a fair way of characterizing his
case? Yes. So Dr. Hansen's granddaughter, Sophie, is a plaintiff, and Jim kindly agreed to be a guardian, serve in a guardian role as a plaintiff for future generations. Because I think, as we all know, Jim's reports are very thorough in alerting our country that it is future generations who will have the biggest problem. And Jim explains that in his recent papers, Children's Burden, I believe, is the title of one of them. But so he is extremely concerned with what's going to happen, the future of our country. Jim's a great American, has spoken out on the science issue since the mid-80s, and so he's kindly agreed to represent, serve in a representative capacity for future generations at the trial.
I wonder if you could maybe help us put some human faces or at least names, help flesh out some of these plaintiffs. Who are some of these youngsters?
You know, that's another excellent point. So we have plaintiffs from all around America, from Rain, Louisiana. We have plaintiffs from Hawaii, from Alaska, from Florida, from Oregon. They're kids from all over our country who, in one way or the other, have been or are being damaged by climate change. And if you go to the Our Children's Trust website, you can see, starting with Chichesca Martinez from Boulder, Colorado, Kelsey Juliana from Eugene, Oregon. We've got plaintiffs from New York, and they each have a unique story. And their story, so, for example, Jaden from Rain, Louisiana, supposedly lived in an area where floods didn't occur, but last year, when the Louisiana was suffering major flooding, unusually major flooding, she woke up one morning and stepped right into climate change when her bedroom was covered with water. And that's extraordinarily unusual, and climate scientists point to climate change as a factor in the flooding occurring in her and Jaden's home. So again, I'd direct you to the website of ourchildrenstrust.org, and you can see a description of each of the federal plaintiffs. Their stories are amazing.
Do any of the 21 kids that you're representing, do any of them have actual health issues, medical issues that they are trying to link to having resulted or made worse by global warming?
Yes, they do. And all that, I don't want to talk about that just yet, because the specifics of that have not yet all come out, but they do have health issues, and that will be the subject of expert testimony at the trial in February.
All right. And I do want to give out the phone number again. If anybody else has a question or a comment, you can call us at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. I asked you before a little bit about some of the state actions. What are the types of claims that can be raised in state courts or are being raised that maybe cannot be raised in the federal action, or vice versa?
That's a fair question. So it's difficult to sue in federal court against a state agency for violating a state constitution. So if you have a right under a particular state constitution, let's say the Colorado state constitution, then it's very difficult to sue in federal court, and that's why these actions are being brought in the various state courts, such as Colorado or Massachusetts or Washington State.
Okay. And have courts in various states rendered decisions recognizing at the state level the public trust doctrine?
Yes, they have. Yes, they have. And so for some states, the public trust doctrine is part of the I'm going to call it the state law, or the concept behind the public trust doctrine, is part of the state law, so that for example, the state of Washington, in its order, dealt with the public trust doctrine, and it talked about the need to reduce emissions levels as a result of the public trust doctrine. So I think that the public trust doctrine is extremely important. There's a big fracking decision in the state of Pennsylvania involving the public trust doctrine. So there are a number of state decisions where the public trust doctrine has been a major factor in limiting either greenhouse gas emissions or fracking or other ways the fossil fuel industry creates global warming.
Okay. And as we've talked about, the core of the Giuliani case is relating to global warming and public trust involved there. But does it also get into other environmental issues, or do other cases that Children's Trust is working on do that? I'm thinking specifically like coal plants, for instance. A major factor is also mercury pollution, which would relate to air and, I think, water contamination. So is that also being raised in any of these cases?
Yeah, in the state cases, we're focused in the federal cases primarily on fossil fuel emissions. But the state cases do get into these other issues. And that's an excellent point.
All right. And I saw, I think it was it was relating to sulfur. And I saw something that gave me the impression that the Trump administration wants to roll back a lot of the sulfur regulations, which I think would make it easier for refineries to operate the way they did before those controls came in. Do you have any information on that?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm not the person to ask about sulfur controls.
All right. Okay, and I think we're ready for our second break, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes with Phil Gregory, and we're talking about from our Children's Trust, and we're talking about the legal actions.
And the time does run by quick, so if you're thinking of calling in, this is the time to do 816-931-5534.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Summer in Miami is getting longer and hotter. When people have air conditioning units in their home, it helps cool down their core body temperature. And that can greatly reduce the risks of a heat-related illness or even death. But not everyone can afford an air conditioner. That means low-income residents must rely on places like malls or libraries when temperatures get dangerously hot. And there are a lot of low-income people in Miami-Dade County. About one-fifth of residents live below the federal poverty level, so it puts a lot of pressure on cooling centers. Caroline Lewis, the executive director of the nonprofit Clio Institute, says cooling centers are not a perfect fix. For example, people do not always know where they are or have a way to get to them. Lewis says another solution is to make sure every home in Miami has an air conditioning unit in at least one room. She's determined to find the funding to make it happen.
This is a fix that has life and death consequences and I think is affordable and doable.
As the climate continues to warm, air conditioning might one day be as crucial to surviving southern summers as heaters are to surviving northern winters. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
KKFI is sustained by generous listener support. Thank you for 30 years of belief in Kansas City Community Radio.
All right, we are back with Phil Gregory. We're talking about legal actions on behalf of children to protect their future in terms of global warming, protect the environment for them. He's with a law firm that is working with Our Children's Trust. We are in the last 9 minutes of this portion. So if you have a call or a question or a comment, give us a call at 816-931-5534. Okay. Phil, we've talked about your goal is to get the court to order the federal government to come up with a plan to address these issues. Are there any states that have come up with plans that you believe would be like a model plan that would be good for the federal government to follow?
Well, there are states such as California. There's other states in New England that have implemented plans, but the plan for the federal government would be unique. There are plans that have been developed since 1989, 1990. If your readers, listeners want to look at documents, there was a major study by the EPA to Congress that was called Policy Options for Stabilizing the Global Climate. Policy Options for Stabilizing Global Climate, December 1990. And that outlines various plans that the federal government could put in place on numerous issues, electrical systems, forestry, methane emissions. There are numerous technical options for reducing greenhouse gas emissions set forth in this plan. And the federal government continued to develop these plans all the way up through the end of the Obama administration. Obviously, the current administration is not doing anything along those lines. But these plans target 2015 as the year we filed our case. They target 2015 as the time frame when, as Kurt Vonnegut aptly put it, the excrement will hit the air conditioning. And so we're right at the point where these plans were saying we need to get something in place or we'll be beyond the point of no return. We didn't put anything in place, and as a result, our kids, our grandkids, and future generations are going to be facing a massive problem that most people don't understand the scope of.
Okay. And you talked about the federal government will come up with maybe a unique plan to comply with. Essentially, the court will set the goal, and the government will come up with a plan to meet that goal. Are there some specific provisions that you believe would have to be in the plan in order for the plan to meet the goal that you want, that you hope to achieve?
Sure. Well, based on the science, the issues go to primarily the transportation sector, the residential and commercial sectors, such things as for transportation, increased fuel efficiency, and urban planning and mass transit. There's numerous options in place for dealing with the energy supply in our country that the current administration is ignoring. Yet these fossil, we'll call them energy options, whether it's solar, other renewables, they're all in place. Forestry, dealing with the problems created by essentially cutting down the trees rather than in essence allowing the the trees to prevent further global warming issues. So there's numerous policy options in place for the federal government. The criteria for selecting these policy options, they should be up to the federal government itself, as long as they're based on urgency and getting us down to a zero carbon footprint. Obviously, the goal for our globe should be getting back to 350 parts per million, but our country should be a major player in doing that.
If the court orders a plan like this, would this be something that might push the government to adopt the Paris Accords that Trump said he's not going to follow?
Well, you know, the Paris Accord is getting to each country getting to a target. And if you talk to the scientists will tell you that Paris doesn't go far enough, that what's in the Paris Agreement is not nearly where our country and other major developed countries should be. So we're not focused on Paris. We're focused on what the science tells us we should do. Paris is the result of political negotiation. And while you can argue about what the right politics are, it's very difficult to argue with this science. And this science says we've got to go much further than Paris, the Paris Accord said we should go.
All right. I want to read a quote. It's from the Children's Trust website. It was a comment made by U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken that you mentioned before. And the quote is, "Exercising my reasoned judgment, I have no doubt that the right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society." Do you want to comment on that quote or elaborate on that any?
Certainly, certainly. So we live in a government that should not be allowed to damage us, whether it's kids through the foster care system, whether it's prisoners in prison. Vulnerable people should not be damaged by our federal government. And it's up to our courts, our courts such as involved in the immigration ban issue, to step up, because a strong and independent judiciary is the cornerstone of our liberties. That's on the wall in the district court in Oregon, and that reminds everybody that it's the role of the courts to say what the law is. And we are thankful that our courts are stepping up when Congress is doing nothing, when our president is harming us. The courts are stepping up to protect our kids and future generations, because neither of the other two branches of government have the leadership to do that. And so Judge Aiken, in stating the words that you did, that there's a right to a climate system that is not harming us, as she puts it, capable of sustaining human life. That's a fundamental right. It's as fundamental as the right to marry. It's as fundamental as any other right. It is the right to life. And if these kids don't have the right to live in a country that's better than I was born in. I was brought up as a Boy Scout, and when you went to a campsite and you camped there, you left it better than you found it. I believe our generation needs to leave our country better then we found it. And the only way to do that is to scale back fossil fuel emissions. Otherwise, we're going to leave a campsite, we're going to leave a country worse off for our kids, our grandkids, and future generations.
All right. We have to end it with that. We are out of time. I want to thank you for being with us, Phil, and the show will be up later this evening.
Thank you. Thank you, Craig.
Okay. Bye.
All right. This is Naturally. I have your events coming up with this weekend and beyond. Rooted Stewardship, hosted by Sustainable Sanctuary Coalition, starts at 7 p.m. tonight and goes until 9 p.m. at the Village Presbyterian Church in Prairie Village at 66th and Mission Road. You can go and learn about KU's Ecosystem Ecology Lab. Special attention will be focused on their soils work and why it's important. By explaining soil ecosystems, the connection between soil ecosystems and human ecosystems, particularly agricultural ones, will be made. The presenter will also help all those who attend apply the information to decisions that they will make and how their actions will create healthy soils, which will then contribute to healthier human communities. An inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power. Indivisible KC hosts a free screening of An Inconvenient Sequel at the Plaza Cinemark this Wednesday, August 9th. You can find the event link on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page to RSVP in order to guarantee seating. Green Governance, hosted by Green Drinks KC and the Kansas Sierra Club, takes place this Thursday, August 10th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Fox and Hound, which is located at 10428 Metcalf in Overland Park. The topic of green governance will be explored and what local elected officials should think about as they make decisions about their community and environment. With the election season in full swing for mayors, city council members, local school and university boards, and water districts, it's a good time to think about what questions to be asking candidates, as well as asking ourselves about what it takes to achieve environmental quality at the local level. Successful candidates for city and county government in the August 1st primary will receive special invitations to the Green Governance event this Thursday, August 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Fox and Hound in Overland Park. Solarization Evaluation, Compost Tea, and Winter Kill Cover Crops, hosted by Prairie Ecosystems Management, takes place Saturday, August 26th, from 1 to 3 p.m. at 3000 East 20th Street in Kansas City. On May 21st, they solarized about 200 square feet of Bermuda grass and weeds at the homegrown community garden there on 20th Street. For this workshop, they will evaluate the effectiveness of soil solarization trials. They treat their sterilized soil with compost tea and plant a cover crop mix that includes species that die when temperatures fall below 25 degrees. Participants will get hands-on experience with soil solarization, planting cover crops, winter kill seed mixes for Kansas City, and use of compost tea to kickstart the soil biology after sterilization. And finally, there's a special showing of Seed, the Untold Story, Tuesday, September 12th at 6 p.m. at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, which is located at 4750 Troost. Seed Savers KC is hosting this, and they share that the world has lost over 94% of its seed varieties. Seeds truly are the life of our world. Without seeds, we would have no food or plant varieties. So you're invited to come see Seed, the Untold Story, a documentary about the serious loss of biodiversity in our world, and learn about how seeds are saved and why it is such an important topic for the future of the earth. There will be a Q&A session after the movie. That's Tuesday, September 12th at the Anita B. Gorman Center at 4750 Troost. Mike, that's all I got.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We don't have a This Week in Water this week, but we do have World Ocean Radio, which we're more than glad to share with you right after this message.
KKFI Crossroads Music Fest is here again. Saturday, September 9th in Kansas City's Crossroads Arts District. Over 35 bands on 9 stages. Tickets are on sale now for just $20. The festival is a diverse slice of the music scene in the area. This year's artists include The Fantastics, Enrique Chi of Making Movies, Javier Mendoza, Crystal Rose, Barclay Martin, Duncan Burnett and Riot, Sarah Morgan, Kelly Hunt, Mundo Nuevo, Kyle Reed, Instant Karma, Hot Club KC, and many more. Saturday, September 9th, the Crossroads Music Fest, a benefit for KKFI. Tickets and more info are available at cmfkc.com.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. The Earth's surface is more than 70% ocean, more water than land, a sea of blue connecting the remaining disconnected green. The nation states claim up to 200 miles from their coasts as areas of national jurisdiction, over which they have the power to exploit, consume, and regulate. But the vast majority of the ocean lies outside those boundaries, an enormous reservoir of biodiversity that presents a very difficult challenge for governance and enforcement, for protection and sustainability. In 1967, international diplomats representing some 160 countries began discussions and negotiation for what became in 1973 the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea that finally in 1994 was ratified by the requisite number of governments as a means, quote, to define the rights and responsibilities of nations with respect to their use of the world's ocean, establishing guidelines for businesses, the environment, and the management of marine natural resources, unquote. Since, international experts have been considering and debating how to create a binding instrument to address the changing accessibility of marine areas outside national jurisdiction and the new technologies, increased scientific knowledge, and expanding resource demands that impact them. An agreement was reached to create a process to navigate the many complex issues, and meetings are now taking place. An overview by the Institute for Sustainable Development and International Relations, based in Paris, provides useful insight into how such an agreement becomes a reality. First, one has to recognize the true nature of the problem. There is no global framework for governance, and the existing conditions are mostly characterized by confusion, conflicting interests, inadequate protections, commercial opportunities, and basic disagreement over core principles around which to organize change. Second, there are the collective, not always agreed perspectives of geopolitical groups, the European Union, the G77, Africa, the Caribbean, and the Pacific, and the reluctant but active and influential outliers, such as the United States, Canada, and Russia. Agenda and list of issues for negotiations include methods for reconciliation of disagreements, the creation of marine protected areas as a conservation structure, the management questions, consultation processes, and environmental assessments, and the integration of technology and skills to allow all nations equal capacity to participate successfully. There will be issues of institutional arrangements by which to decide, coordinate, and review, the potential undermining of existing relationships, the specific and volatile regulation of fisheries, and, of course, the penultimate matter of funding. What does it cost, and who pays for it? If you think this is complex and time-consuming, it is. How long will it take? Will it innovate and truly address the sustainability intentions? If or when agreement is reached, will the nations ratify, contribute, or pay attention? Over the years of following the evolution of international ocean policy, I've become totally respectful of the many individuals who contribute to this process, indeed who dedicate their lives and careers to the detailed, tedious, incremental advances that are required to produce any kind of practical, applicable, effective international agreement. This is the invisible part of policy creation. The continuous meetings in faraway places, the word-by-word, line-by-line, issue-by-issue discussions, and consensus agreements, the uncertainty of approval or indecision back home, the rigors and restrictions of international law, and the ever-changing political fronts as dynamic and directional as ocean weather and the sea itself. I could never do this essential work, and I am in awe and grateful for the knowledge, durability, and patience of those who do. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is produced by the World Ocean Observatory in association with WERU-FM, Blue Hill, Maine. World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network. Find our podcast on iTunes and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC, on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.